Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 2nd of February 2022, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with me, David Taylor, and him, Phil Bishop, to discuss the news and current events in the UK construction industry. Good morning, Phil. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling much better than my lateral flow test tells me I should be feeling. I tested positive a few days ago, last Friday it was, but I wouldn't have known it. I only did a test because we've going to an event, I thought, better check myself out, and I was taken quite by surprise. First time I've seen that second line.
So no ill effects?
Not really. I think I blew my nose yesterday once. That's about it.
Wow, okay. Well, I'd say I wish you a swift recovery, but I'm not sure that recovery is really the right word. But anyway, I'm glad you haven't got a worse dose of it than you have.
Yeah, I've just gotta hunker down and wait till I'm allowed out again.
Yeah, how long have you got to wait now?
Well, I was clear yesterday, so I think if I'm clear today, I'm home and dry. But it's kind of complicated because a lot of the official sources of information are out of date. So some places still say, 10 days regardless, and some say two clear tests and then you're okay. And it's all terribly confusing.
Oh, well, just stay indoors for the time being. It's not very nice outside anyway.
I'm glad to see that I'm not the only person confused, though. Some of our most important people in the country appear to be rather confused about what the rules are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you're in good company, I suppose.
No parties, though.
No parties, no, certainly not. Well, is any news caught your attention since we last spoke?
Well, I've been trying to get excited about this levelling up thing that now we know what it is. I haven't actually seen, time of speaking, the actual levelling up white paper has yet to drop, but the Department for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, DLUHC, has put out a press release last week explaining the urban regeneration focus of the white paper. And today, the 2nd of February, it's put out another press release fleshing out a little bit more and setting out the more detail of the white paper, which is supposedly being published today, setting out 12 missions. And it's... Whereas the first press release basically said levelling up means urban regeneration. We're gonna, as Margaret Thatcher said many years ago, 1986, 1987, whenever it was, it's time to do something about those inner cities. And that spawned urban development corporations and this, that and the other, which was pretty successful in a lot of places at regenerating places. Didn't necessarily always bring back that many jobs in the long run. Now, of course, it's not about manufacturing industry that's dead and needs replacing or reviving on the back of that. It's retail industry which has brought about crisis in high streets, and it seems to me the focus of the urban regeneration thing is very much centred on trying to respond to the death of the high street. That was last week's statement. This week's statement is all about these 12 missions. Let me just call it up, sort of a mission statement. And it's terribly broad. It includes things like reducing the gap in... Different parts of the country have got different life expectancies. And part of levelling up is to reduce the gap. And it's not to start shooting people in London as soon as they turn 80 to make it level. That'll be levelling down, of course. But it's to try and make people live longer where they're not currently living longer. So I think they're saying the average life expectancy by 2030 will go up by 5 years.
There's absolutely no substance in that, though, is there? I mean, how are you going to do that? Maybe it'll be in the white paper, but there's certainly no clues to that just at the moment, is there?
Well, it's not a Department of housing and communities thing anyway. Clearly, it's the Department of Health and it's not just health, it's also social services. And in fact, I think social services is the big, what's the word, the Cinderella area of government policy. It's been rather shabbily treated and forgotten about. And we, you know, it's all very well clapping for nurses and pumping money into the NHS, but it's actually social care, which is where I think the greater crisis lies in this country.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think we that's become quite clear over the last couple of years. But I mean, it seems to, you're absolutely right. Broad is the correct way of describing it, because it does take into account just about everything you can think of. Anything that's wrong in the out in the regions, everything's compared to London. We're going to eliminate literacy and innumeracy by refocusing on education out in the regions. We're going to spend more on public sector research and development out in the regions. It's all sort of motherhood and apple pie stuff, isn't it? You can't argue with it.
Absolutely not. But
and they're not going to deliver it for another 10 years?
8 years now. But
oh, is it 8 years? Okay.
What I've yet to get my head around, the introduction to this press release today says, 12 bold national levelling up missions given status in law will shift government focus and resources to Britain's forgotten communities through 2020s, throughout the 2020s. Now, these 12 missions are being given status in law. One of these missions, I will read to you, it says, by 2030, homicide, serious violence and neighbourhood crime will have fallen, focused on the worst affected areas. So they're going to embed in law that murders will fall in the next 8 years. Eh?
Yeah.
I mean, so nice. I'm stumped.
No, I know. Number 9 in the list of missions is another one, which is, if you like, very light on detail, improve well-being in every area of the UK. I mean...
Yes.
How can that be a mission? It's got absolutely no targets.
Fabulous aspiration, but I don't know how you can make it, you know, legislate to make people have pride in place. What? Anyway, we haven't seen the white paper, so I think we might have to return to this one and maybe get... It would be lovely to get someone who actually does understand what it's all about on.
Yeah, yeah, that would be good.
We've got a couple of guests this week, haven't we?
We have indeed, yes. Our first guest is Sarah Meek, Managing Director of Mates in Mind, the mental health charity set up in 2016 to improve the mental well-being of people in workplaces all over the UK. And I think, Sarah, not exclusively in construction, but mainly in construction. Is that right?
That's right, mainly in construction. We also work within transport and logistics as well. Mm-hmm. But we were set up by the Healthcare and Construction Leadership Group as a result of the research that came through via the construction industry.
And of course, mental health, I think, is a topic which has emerged very rapidly over the last few years. I think we're all much more aware of mental health issues than we previously were. But you've been doing some research. And I think, well, the reason you're speaking to us today is that you have done some recent research into mental health and the issues experienced by people in certain parts of the construction industry, mainly self-employed people and people working in smaller companies. Is that right?
Absolutely right. To begin with, we worked with a lot of the larger construction companies, but realising that through the supply chain, a large number of people who come onto site and are facing difficulties with mental health are actually at the further end of the industry. So as you say, those who are working by themselves as sole traders, those who are working in smaller businesses, and our research was funded by BNCE, and we had a response of over 300 people coming back to us with their thoughts on how they're feeling and where their pressure points are at the moment.
Right. BNCE, by the way, is a non-profit sort of financial services organisation, is it? Sort of pension provider.
They are. They're a grant maker as well. So they they have a large grant application that you can apply for research funding for.
And so what were the main findings of your research? Was there anything particularly shocking that was uncovered?
Yes, I mean, what we found was that people were very honest with us, which was fantastic. The average age of those who were responding was about 47. And it was an even split between those who are self-employed and those who are actually working as sole traders, and smaller businesses as well. We found that about a third of people currently are working with the severe mental health issues at the moment. And we know that that's actually that's not a great place to be, because what that can lead to and what people are reporting is very high levels of insomnia. So they're not sleeping at night. They're starting to find coping mechanisms around alcohol and non-prescription drug use. And if you think about that in the wider context around accidents on site and the ongoing spiraling into a mental health situation, That's not a great place to be. People are feeling that, half of them were feeling their workload was too high, that they're having problems with colleagues, with work pressures and financial worries. You know, has the actual pandemic escalated that because of the financial flows coming to that part of the industry and supplies as well?
I wondered, I mean, how much of this is new and how much of it has been going on for a long time and we just haven't really noticed it or haven't quantified it in any way? Is it a new phenomenon?
It's certainly new to ask that particular part of the industry. And we know that, you know, along with mental health, people are finding that they're not reaching out necessarily to find the support that they require, which is why Mates in Mind working with a lot of the organisations means that we can support an organisation and we can support people through actually looking at the culture around and how mental health is discussed and trying to destigmatise it so that more and more people come forward to seek help. But, for this to be, you know, a third of people working with severe mental health and for that to actually now be impacting on sleep patterns, low mood, and for people to actually be thinking about quitting and leaving their job, leaving the industry as a result of this, that's not good.
No.
And we've got a fifth of people who, you know, only a fifth, one in five, would actually ask for help from their GP. So they are coping alone.
And I suppose people, the self-employed sole traders, and maybe even people working in smaller companies, perhaps they don't have the same sort of support network that you would have if you were working for a tier one contractor or, you know, a big organization with a well-resourced human resources department. So I suppose a lot of these people must feel that they're on their own and they have nowhere, you know, to turn for support or advice.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes, they don't necessarily have the luxury of an employee assistance program or an HR department. We know that mental health first aiders have been, you know, really widespread across the industry, which is great. But for us, we want to do more around the prevention side of things. We don't want somebody to reach crisis point before they reach out and before people notice. And, you know, it's quite a shocking statistic that we've got the same percentage of people who are considering self-harming as we do would consider counselling. And they're finding their support mechanisms through friends and family. And we need to change that. We need to have their colleagues, people on site, people, you know, looking out for each other and actually asking that question, you know, are you okay? Noticing changes in behaviour and then actually being equipped and know what to do as a result of someone actually opening up as well. You know, how to ask those open questions and where to signpost to if someone does feel that they can open up and share how they are feeling.
So you've articulated the issues, but and I'm aware that Mates in Mind has done a great job at raising awareness. What I know less about is what actually, beyond raising awareness, you are doing to address whether it's the causes or the impact of mental health problems.
Okay, so what we do with our supporters is we'll actually look at their data, their information to begin with. So actually, what is the problem they're trying to fix? Is it that they've got, you know, high accident rates? Is it they've got high absenteeism? Have they actually had, you know, a suicide of one of their team members? And that's very often the way that people will find us, but a large percentage find us through word of mouth. So we'll look at the data, we'll look at how well skilled and how well equipped the line managers are to actually start that conversation and to spot the signs. We'll also then work through, you know, how policies and their culture can change, how they can embrace working in a different way. And we'll do an annual review with them to see where that journey has taken people. We'll put them in touch with other organisations and where we've seen best impact. And we will absolutely support them every step of the way through that process to make sure that what we're trying to do is to obviously get the message out to boots on the ground, but we also have to have the line managers equipped with the skill set to be able to have that knowledge and that awareness of what to do.
The whole question of mental health, I said at the outset that it's very much a live topic, has been for a few years now. I mean, I can remember when I first started writing about construction, there was the focus was on safety, so you know, falls, trips, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then it gradually moved to health, and we were talking about occupational health and long-term health issues. And now the focus has shifted more to mental health. It's sort of become even more focused. And I wondered, is this just a sort of an awakening of awareness within the industry and perhaps in society more widely, or is it a symptom of something else?
David is trying to avoid talking about the snowflake generation, I suspect.
Well, I am, because there have been one or two high-profile comments about this very recently. The most obvious one being, I think, Joanna Lumley, who was on another podcast, not ours, very recently, saying that, you know, I think, in fact, I've got a quote here. She says, this is a horrible thing to say, so she's preparing us. But I think the mental health thing is being overplayed at the moment, because anybody who is even remotely sad says that they've got mental health problems. And she came in for an awful lot of criticism for that immediately. I don't think she's actually issued an apology yet, but that might very well come. But I think that it highlights an issue, I think probably a mindset within wider society, that, you know, these are just softies. These are people who don't have the resilience. They should just man up. Yeah, they should get on with it. You know, buck your ideas up and stop whinging. I mean, do you think that that's still a prevalent attitude particularly within construction, of course?
I think certainly the phrase man up, think is probably one of the most damaging aspects that people have, that inferring that a man can't actually have, you know, a mental health condition and should somehow shield how they're feeling, I think leads to some of that stigma and that culture of not feeling that they can come forwards. I think what's quite alarming, particularly within the construction industry, is that, you know, research has shown that you're 4.7 times more likely to end your life through suicide if you work in construction. And not only that, but two construction workers every day are taking their own lives. So I think that those stark statistics on their own mean that we have to do more. I think what we're also seeing is a generational issue. We've got the apprentices coming through the system who have gone through education, who are very used to being in touch with their emotions and how they're feeling. And they're perhaps coming into organisations where workplace stress is something that is normalised, it's accepted, but actually there is so much that can be done to avoid workplace stress, to risk assess it, but also to actually put in place steps to reduce it as well. We have a very powerful video on our website, which I would recommend you and any of your listeners to watch. It's called Chris's Story. And it absolutely highlights the impact that workplace stress can have on somebody who didn't have a mental health condition to begin with. But actually, that coping mechanism and just feeling you have to keep going because the project is required, the deadlines are there, and the impact that that can have with somebody ending their own life and leaving behind a family and colleagues who just don't know what happened and what more could have been done.
Those suicide figures are certainly very shocking, and they really do stand out. Now, do we have any idea why construction workers might be more vulnerable, more likely to suffer from poor mental health than people in, say, manufacturing or retail or hospitality.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the causative effects have been well published. It certainly looks like, you know, working away from home a lot of the time, that the financial pressures and strains of working in that industry, the physical toll as well of just having to keep going. We have to think that the construction industry, as you know, continued throughout the pandemic. A lot of people were getting, you know, abuse as well for being seen as potential COVID carriers because they were continuing to go into work. So whilst everybody was clapping on a Thursday evening for the NHS workers, we didn't see the same level of recognition for the construction workers who keep going. And I think, you know, when we look at finance, we look at family pressures, we look at relationships, I think, you know, a lot of people are able to cope and to manage with everyday stresses and strains. But if you start adding in additional pressures into that situation, then you end up with, you know, a really perfect storm, if you like, for somebody where perhaps they feel that the only way out is to end their own life.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple of specific questions, and you may or may not have either data or insight into. One is, you mentioned about the physical labour involved in many construction jobs. And I can imagine, just like often cases of top athletes, top sports players who are playing, you know, carrying injuries and having cortisone injections or whatever, I can imagine equally that there are any number of construction workers who aren't, you know, they haven't got their arm in a sling, but they're carrying injuries which perhaps, you know, they ought to stop work, but they can't quite justify it. So they're chomping on, you know, horse tranquilizers or something maybe a bit stronger than aspirin and Nurofen. Is there any data, or do you have any insight on that particular thing of injured, for want of a better word, construction workers working through the pain barrier?
Well, it's interesting. So the research actually did show that in the last 2 weeks of them completing the survey, that the second highest after poor sleep being at 75%, at 70% of people were reporting musculoskeletal pain. So you're absolutely right. They are continuing through that. They might not have, you know, a lot of the time you take time off and, you know, are you going to be paid or not? But also, if you think about it, if someone does have crutches or they have, you know, their arm in a sling, people will ask them how they are.
You can see it. Yeah,
exactly. Mental health looks the same as everybody else. You know, you don't have that same visual thing. It can be a very hidden aspect to somebody. And we know that it's predominantly male dominated. And we know that, you know, men aren't always the best at coming forwards and actually saying, you know, I need a bit of help here. We've seen it through, you know, the military charities as well, where I've worked previously. People don't always want to come forward. They see it as a sign of weakness. And that's what we need to change. We need to change that to be something that is embraced and that support is there. And that it's the same as having a physical, you know, adaptations can be made if you're on crutches. Why not for mental health as well?
So I absolutely agree with your point. I take your point, but I think there's a slight misunderstanding of men. They won't admit to mental health problems, but we sure as hell will tell everyone about our niggling back or our pains. We will moan and make sure everyone knows what a martyr we are and how we're struggling through the pain barrier. But but you're right, we won't admit to any mental weakness on that.
No, yeah. That's a very good point, actually. And Sarah, my next question was, is the problem concentrated at a particular end of the industry? I mean, is it a site-based problem, essentially? Are people who work in office environments in construction, are they equally affected by these
Absolutely.
Problems?
Absolutely. I mean, the story I was telling you earlier around Chris, you know, he was one of the managers. So it absolutely doesn't discriminate. It doesn't discriminate against background. It doesn't discriminate against job. And that's why, you know, we need to have as many people equipped and having those questioning and that supporting mechanism as absolutely possible, and to know where to signpost a colleague to. And it doesn't have to be, you know, we know there are a lot of females now working in the industry, and our work with time-wise that we are doing around flexible working, you know, they've seen some tremendous results in actually offering some pilot sites the opportunity to do flexible working. So, you know, dads being able to pick up their children from school and the impact, the really positive impact that that can have both on them and their mental health and well-being, but also their family life as well. But what the research has shown with TimeWise is that it didn't have a negative impact on productivity for the organization. So I think we absolutely need to look as holistically as we can to make sure, as you were saying earlier, you know, that it's not just a mental health, it's a general well-being approach to looking after our colleagues, because we want to attract people into the industry. Mm. We don't want people to be leaving. We want it to be an industry that's considered by women, by school leavers, by, you know, military service leavers as well, as being something that is recognised and supported.
Can I follow my previous question, which is about medicating with painkillers? It strikes me, it appears to me, that there's possibly even more prevalent problem, far more prevalent problem, with people medicating with probably less likely recreational drugs, much more likely alcohol. Most of us can happily have 4 or 5 pints of beer down the pub without it doing us any physical or mental harm at all. But when it becomes a lifestyle thing night after night, it becomes a vicious circle. I mean, I suppose it's chicken and egg whether the mental health problems are exacerbated by alcohol or caused by alcohol and or other substances. Mm. How, in the work that Makes the Mind have done, the studies that you've done, what percentage of cases involve alcohol excess or recreational drug excess?
Yeah, I mean, it featured very strongly in the research findings that that alcohol and non-prescription drug use were featuring as coping mechanisms. So that was, you know, it was certainly up there within the top three findings for us.
Coping mechanism or cause? It's got to be a cause as well, hasn't it? I mean, if you could educate not just construction industry, everyone, myself included, hands up, that we're drinking too much, wouldn't that go a huge way to tackling the problems?
I think that we need to look at all avenues, really. I mean, in working with the organisations, we do a lot of awareness sessions with their teams, with their HR. We look at, you know, their approaches to it, and absolutely what we want to avoid is accidents as well. So people need to be on their A game if they're at work particularly in a construction environment. So perhaps more research is required, Phil, maybe.
You are doing some more research, I believe, aren't you? Did I read that you're currently conducting some focus groups with some of the participants in your
That's
research?
That's right. Yeah. So whilst we had, you know, a really strong and positive response to the questionnaire, a number of people have put themselves forward to be interviewed on one-to-one basis. And that's forming the next stage of the question, of the research. And the full report will be available at the beginning of May, which will incorporate not only our preliminary findings, but also the follow-ups in the one-to-one interviews as well, to pick out common themes and be able to dig deeper in how people are.
I'm sure you get a lot from you know, the corporate side. You get a lot of support from the, you know, the tier one contractors, the Balfour Beattys and the Costains and people like that. Mm-hmm. It must be more difficult to engage with the SMEs, isn't it? Because first of all, there are so many of them.
Absolutely.
How do you go about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. That was a challenge for us when it came to actually launching the questionnaire. This part of the industry? So we did find a number of Facebook groups. We also worked with a couple of trade counters as well to encourage them to put it out through their social media. But we know there are approximately 1 million people in this part of the industry. So it is hard to reach, and we're relying on the big tier ones and the sites to actually cascade it down through their chains, make it visible on site. Ideally have part of a site induction that anybody coming onto site actually knows the support that's available there and the approach that they can adopt.
And talking of support, presumably Mates in Mind does have that availability if you're suffering with mental health, if, you know, you think you're close to the edge, you can get in touch with Mates in Mind.
So we don't have a direct link with anybody who's at that crisis point, but we would absolutely advocate that they contact Lighthouse Construction, the helpline that's available 24/7, or Samaritans as well. But they do actually reach out and find somebody to talk to.
You mentioned the Lighthouse Club. I should just mention at this point, because they put out something yesterday. They've launched a new service called Text Hard Hat. to 852-58 is the number, which is that number already exists for a service called Shout, but a specific construction team for that service. Text Hardhat to 852-58, as well that's as right. their 24/7 phone line that the Lighthouse Club has got. Final question, Sarah. People want to know more about Mates in Mind. How do they find you?
Absolutely. So we're across social media channels, Mates in Mind. We've got our website, matesinmind.org, and I'm available on LinkedIn as well if anybody wants to reach out directly. But we're very keen to hear from people, whether they're interested in our research, whether they're interested in becoming supporters and finding out more what they can do within their organisation, or ideally if they're looking for any fundraising as well, opportunities to either raise funds for us or to become corporate partners.
Well, that's great.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
David, should we move on to our next subject and bring our next guest in?
Yes. Yes, please.
Well, our next guest is Nick Barnes of Allied Mechanical Engineering, based in Cardiff, who contacted me last week and said, why aren't you writing anything about reverse charge VAT? Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought, well, we've written loads about what a bad thing this was going to be when it came in. And then it occurred to me that actually since it came in, I'm aware...
And we haven't said anything about
it. I'm aware of two mentions of it. One, we reported in Morgan Sindall in their half-year results last summer, said that their stock of cash had gone up thanks to reverse charge VAT. Their cash balances have benefited. And then last week, T. Clark, a Tier 2 contractor, in their financial results were saying that their cash balances had been impacted by reverse charge VAT. So suddenly reverse charge VAT, having slightly sort of pushed it to one side, been put in my consciousness that we've been neglecting it. So I said to Nick Barnes, good point. Come on and tell us all about it. And he's very kindly agreed to do so and is here this morning. Nick, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, tell me about Allied Mechanical Engineering. I know you're based in Cardiff. I know you work for the construction industry. What's your business? What do you do?
Well, we're a mechanical contractor. So we do all commercial heating, commercial plumbing, ventilation. Been going about 20 years. And yeah, we do a lot of work for main contractors or tier one. And also we do quite a lot of work direct for health boards, councils, public bodies, fire frameworks. So we sort of have a bit of both, to be honest. But obviously with this reverse VAT, it's been a bit of a paperwork exercise as well.
Perhaps to start off, Nick, just remind us, I know you're not an accountant, you're a businessman, but reverse charge VAT, what is it and when did it come in?
Well, traditionally, construction industry, obviously you have the VAT process, when you send a bill, you add VAT on top, and vice versa when you have bills from your suppliers and material suppliers. But this has been in the offing for a few years, and it was delayed for a year in 2019 and was, I think, brought in back in March 21, right in the middle of the pandemic, which I don't think helped. But I think it's had a mixed impact on, as you said then, on different firms. On tier one contractors, they've had a bit of a cash boost, a short-term one, because the likes of us are not adding VAT now to our bills, so they've benefited.
So when you charge when you put your bill into a tier one contractor, because you're not including VAT, it's forgive me, VAT 20% is it still VAT?
Yeah, 20%. Yeah.
So your bills are 20% smaller than they otherwise would have been.
Yeah. So temporarily. So for a quarter, you're losing that 20% of cash. But then on the other hand, when you have subcontractors working for yourselves under the CIS scheme, then they will not charge VAT to you. So it sort of goes along the chain.
Hmm.
But then obviously we have suppliers and materials, plants, which still charge VAT. So that's where sort of pinch comes, where say if we have a boiler project or buying a air handling unit, we still pay the VAT on that plant, and then we're waiting for the cash from the VAT effectively to come back to us.
How long is that time lag?
It's about usually a quarter. So you put your VAT submissions in every quarter, and then I think it's a month and a week when you have that payment back. Touch wood for us. I must admit, they've been pretty good so far. But I have heard stories of people waiting for, say, £80,000 of VAT for one quarter and haven't received it because they've marked something wrong on the VAT return. And of course, they're trying to phone HMRC and trying to get some help on that. I just think with what's been going on in the construction industry, this is another thing that, especially businesses for the likes of ourselves, it's another thing we've got to think of now.
When I was going to say, it sounds as if it's people like you, you're people in the sort of middle of the supply chain who are, if you like, sort of caught in, you know, caught between two stools, because the people who would have been, you're presumably your service is still VAT-able. It still attracts VAT, yeah. But you don't get the VAT. It's paid by your client directly to HMRC. So you're bypassed. You don't get that cash flow now, but you still have to pay your suppliers VAT on the products that they sell to you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Suppliers of products rather than suppliers of services, yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
So you've got that, you're almost temporarily out of pocket.
Oh,
really.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. But some of the excuses you hear for some contractors saying, we don't need to, we're not part of the scheme. I've heard some great things, like people make excuses why we don't have to deduct the VAT from them. So
really,
can we think, yes, you know, we're supplying plants, but it's with an operator, but it's only for this term, so we don't need to be. It's more paperwork exercise, if anything, than, you know, as well as the cash elements.
You said that HMRC actually hadn't been too bad from your your personal point of view. But do you think that you are unavoidably disadvantaged by this system? Do you think that it's just the way it's being managed, the way it's being administered, that is the problem? Or do you think that there's a fundamental problem with the new VAT system that disadvantages people in your position, people further down the supply chain?
I think you're right. We said earlier, so ones in the middle are getting squeezed.
Yeah.
So I've been talking to our subcontractors, and the smaller ones where they've got one or two people employed, they say actually it's a benefit to them because they don't have to think about paying the VAT at the end of every quarter. So they say, actually, it helps with their cash management, which, you know, is a bit of a sad state of affairs, really.
Well, it reduces their sort of administration burden, doesn't it? I suppose there's slightly less paperwork for them to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you must have a fairly substantial VAT bill, from your suppliers, because presumably the equipment that you install, the equipment that you pass on to your clients, and it's not cheap. No, exactly.
Well, exactly. The thing with price rises at the moment happening, it just exacerbates it, really. We've gone from a big sort of VAT bill every month now to the complete opposite now. We're a creditor to HMRC.
Yeah.
I can imagine that first quarter must have been really difficult for you, that first transition from moving from paying that to not paying that, or charging that, I should say, to your clients to not charging that. That first quarter where you had 20% less money coming in that you're expecting, but then maybe you've learnt to accommodate it, and it's just if whether the cash comes in today or 3 months, it doesn't really matter as long as the cash is still coming through all the time. Is that a fair assessment, or is it still difficult?
Yeah, it's more of an experience of it, if anything, because we're quite conservative the way we run the business. So, you know, in terms of the actual deduction in cash, we think, we can cover that for the time being. But it was quite surprising, really, what effect it does have. And as you say, like, especially when you look at the bigger tier two contractors, it has a massive effect on the short-term cash of the business. But then, you know, what happens with that? What they sort of put the pressure on further down the supply chain then to the smaller contractors. So I think it just exacerbates what is going on in the industry at the moment with the supply chains.
Would you like to see it scrapped? Would it help you if it was scrapped?
Ideally, yes, but that's not going to happen because I read somewhere that HMRC will benefit to the tune of £100 million a year in lost VAT. So,
right, which means all of us will benefit.
Theoretically, yeah.
Well, that was the whole idea behind the change, wasn't it? That the government had decided that it was missing out on VAT. It wasn't getting the VAT that it should have been getting. So this mechanism was introduced in order to try and close that loop. So it looks like it's working for them.
Absolutely.
Maybe it isn't working for the people actually out there trying to earn a living.
Yeah, it's just, as I say, just one something else to add, that it's just discouraging, I think, people from entering the industry as well, setting up new firms. I think I read somewhere that they reckon there's 35% less firms in the construction industry than there was a couple of years ago. You know, and say when you work in the supply chain, you get deduct retentions, now the VAT, and also if you're CIS, if you're quite a new company, you get deducted the tax element on the labour. So if you're working for one of these big contractors, then, you know, I suppose when you have your payments, you're thinking, there's not much left there.
No, exactly.
But you're hanging on in there. It sounds like you're doing okay, though. You're busy enough.
Yeah, definitely. It's pretty busy out there for the short term. It's just, I think after the pandemic, there's quite a few people who are probably not as enthused with the industry as they used to be and having second thoughts about what they're doing. So I think it's just about, it's going to be a long term of all these effect of all these things happening to the industry.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, presumably, if HMRC are working efficiently, people will get the money due to them within a reasonable amount of time. I don't know whether or not it's the pandemic which has actually slowed down the flow of cash from HMRC to the people who are due payment. But it sounds as if it hasn't actually, this alone hasn't affected your business adversely. It's just made life perhaps a little bit more difficult for you.
Yeah, I think hit the nail on the head there really with that. Yeah. It's just something else to add to the bureaucracy. Yeah. And, you know, not only you have to collect money now from your customers, you've got to collect it from HMRC.
Yeah.
It's better to getting money back from the tax man than just giving it to him all the time, though, isn't it?
Yeah, psychologically, I suppose, yeah. you do like to be one step ahead of him, to be honest, but
I have no idea what that must feel like. Oh, well. Well, maybe it will settle down. Maybe the system is just sort of, you know, experiencing some teething problems and that they'll get it sorted out. Or maybe it's simply a matter of an uncomfortable transition that, you know, for companies like you, it's been quite an upheaval from an administrative point of view. And it's just a matter of settling into the routine and maybe things will be better. Or are you not that optimistic?
Yeah, I think to be honest, the industry is quite resilient. So I think they'll, as anything, they'll just get used to it and take it as part of the cost of doing business, as it were.
Yeah.
Have you been able to gently up your prices because you're not adding VAT? Psychologically, it seems like your bills are lower.
Well, the way the industry works is that, to be honest, you never sort of count VAT in your. It's always plus VAT.
Yeah.
And the application certification process in the industry, VAT is only considered really when, you know, you put your final invoice in when you get your payment. So, prices are definitely going up at the moment. It's just hard to keep up with materials at the moment.
But that's probably more to do with input costs, isn't it? Like, you know, materials and labour.
Yeah, materials, it's probably on average, 10% a month at the moment.
10% a month?
On pipework and fittings, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just a constant thing at the moment. So it's a.
How long has that been going on? You say 10% a month just for 1 month?
I think the last 6 months, I think it's been quite acute, the price rises.
That's soon going to be doubled then, because, you know, compound, it doesn't take 10 months for it to double, that, does it?
Well, yeah, but luckily for us, we don't work on very many long-term projects, but I would like to see what the cost of materials now are on a sort of 2-3 year project, you know, if obviously you've already agreed your price.
Yeah.
Are you able to put in your tender or your pitch that this is my price, but the materials will be, at the moment, that's the material cost, but this is liable to increase because material prices are going up, or do you have to commit to a materials price?
Generally, do you have to commit? It's through tendering processes and they're fixed prices for until acceptance, and then when you accept it, that's your price for the project. Obviously, if there's changes made, variations through the job, you can charge the latest prices they were for your materials.
If the job changes. But, yeah. But you can't shift the risk of materials price rises onto the client at all.
Oh, don't, no.
You have to take that.
Well, not at the moment anyway, but whether that, if this continues, whether some, whether there's an opportunity to start saying to clients, look, you know, you've got to be understanding with what's happening. And, but I don't know. I haven't seen that before, to be honest, in our industry.
Open book accounting and partnering and things don't filter down to local authority heating and plumbing, do they?
Well, not sort of our level. I suppose on the very big projects, you know, where the tier one contractors got a bit more clout, they can sort of request a client to take that in consideration. But sort of the jobs we do, there's not very many opportunities to do that.
Got to take up the risk.
Yeah.
10% inflation in prices for what you're paying for your materials is huge. I mean, I'm stunned by that. I knew it was, yeah. I've been reading all about and hearing all about the rises, but never seen 10% a month.
Yeah, I think it's because obviously there's a lot of talk about steelwork and things like that. You know, the price rises on that, so that's taken quite a lot of the coverage up on it. But I think at a lower level, insulation as well is rocketing all the time.
We've still got the big energy price rise to come, haven't we? I think it's going to be April, I think, we're expecting the electricity prices to suddenly shoot up when all the fixed rate accounts or bills, whatever, end.
Yeah, it's just definitely, it's only one way it's going to go, I think, definitely short to medium term.
Right, well.
Rather depressing outlook.
Sorry to depress you. But,
Well, Nick, on that somewhat gloomy note, I want to say thank you very much for joining us, and keep raising your prices yourself so you can stay ahead of the game.
It would be nice, but you can only carry on, and I think there's plenty of work out there as well, so that's the good thing with the industry.
That's the main thing.
Yeah, that's the good thing.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Nick Barnes from Allied Mechanical Engineering, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, is that us done then, David? Anything else we'd like to talk about?
I think that's probably it. I'm just glad to say that I'm not seeing 10% input cost increases every month. That was a shocking statistic we just heard. But I think on that bombshell, we could probably wrap it up.
Yes, I think we better. Alrighty, well, thank you everyone for listening to another episode of Reconstruction with David and I. And we will be back in 2 weeks' time, as per usual, for the time being. But thank you very much for now. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.